Is there a favorite element about the writing process for you? I feel like you've done so many different iterations of editorial.
I just love hearing about people's work and the creative things they do and their influences. And when you can kind of see a thread, you know, there are times when I say, oh, this reminds me of, you know, historic building or architect. And then the designer says, oh, I was looking at this. You know, it's cool to kind of get in the heads of designers and see how they work.
Welcome to Talk Shop. I'm Ariel Oaken, a New York-based interior designer, writer, and editor looking to bring a little bit of magic into our homes every day. After years as a writer and editor in the interiors world, I founded my own editorial site, Fenimore Lane, in 2020, and the Talk Shop interview series was born. Each week, I delve into the personal experiences of the top interior designers and tastemakers around the globe. For this week's guest, I'm so happy to welcome my friend, the talented interiors editor and writer, Hadley Keller, to the podcast. Hadley currently serves as Director of Editorial and Community Engagement at the Design Leadership Network, a community of top interior designers across the country. Previously, Hadley was Digital Director at House Beautiful, the nation's oldest continuously published shelter magazine, where she oversaw all digital content as well as brand franchises, including the next wait list of On the Rise designers, which I am so grateful to be on. Hadley also worked at Architectural Digest as a market editor, design writer, and notably as the founding editor of AD Pro. She splits her time between New York and Washington, where she sits on the board of the Oasis Alliance, a nonprofit providing pro bono design service to trauma survivors, and is a member of the White House Historic Association's Next Gen Leaders cohort. She is a frequent speaker at design industry events and published her first book about the architecture at Windsor in Florida with Vendome in 2021. Please join me as I welcome Hadley to the podcast. Hadley, thank you so much for doing this.
Congrats on adding another thing to your, you know, growing media.
Thank you. I'm just a chicken with my head cut off at all times, but I'm excited to do it. It's so fun to be having these conversations with people.
I know. You know, it's funny. I think about that sometimes. I've been so lucky in my career as a journalist to interview amazing people. And there are sometimes we have conversations that are so good that I think to myself, oh my God, I wish this were, you know, live. Like, I wish people could listen.
I know. Well, in prepping for this, I was thinking about our conversation a couple weeks ago about editorial in general and the state of editorial and pitching. So we're going to get into all of that.
Love it.
Well, to kick off the conversation, can you describe your style in three words or less?
If it were going to be just three words, I would probably just say an eclectic mix.
Oh, yes. I love that.
Although on a note to that, which is just a funny aside story, one time an ex-boyfriend of mine who obviously did not appreciate maximalist style.
They never do.
Right? He said that he was talking to his mother about how I worked in design, blah, blah. And she said, well, what's Hadley's design style? And he said, crowded. Obviously, that is an insult, but I think I'd like to reclaim it. So also, sure, my design style is crowded.
I think we should reclaim that because it means that you're a collector, which
is lovely. Exactly.
How it should be. So speaking of DLN, for those who may not know, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and where you are at this point in your life right now?
Absolutely. So I am a long-term design editor turned, I'm still an editor.
Yeah.
But work for the Design Leadership Network, which is a community of interior designers, architects, landscape designers, related professionals. We've got some photographers, stylists, design publicists are basically a professional organization aiming to kind of support designers at the top of their game. And my title is the Director of Editorial and Community Engagement. So I'm leading editorial for us, which we'll probably get a lot more into that. We have a quarterly magazine and some other fun things coming up, including book projects. And then the community engagement aspect kind of speaks to, you know, the fact that everything we do, whether it's editorial or educational, it really revolves around our community and bringing people together. So I do a lot of panels and hosting events, you know, behind the scenes tours, things like that. And before that, I started my career at AD. I worked on print and then on digital. I started AD Pro. And then I went to House Beautiful, where I was for about 4 years and did a lot of fun things there. I ran the Next Wave franchise, which Ariel, I know you know intimately.
Hadley very kindly helped me on with that amazing career milestone, which I will never forget.
Well, that was, you know, well-deserved and exciting, but that was I loved doing so much was, you know, I think the thread throughout my career has been I love the design industry. I love kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say discovering because I think that, you know, that makes sound a little too self-important, but, you know, seeing and helping talented people kind of storytell and get their work out there. And, you know, in a way, I'm just kind of doing that in a different way now at the DLN than I was in magazines.
Yeah. And you're always such a cheerleader for people in the industry. And I think that's the through line in your career is you do such a great job at nurturing talent and really coaching them through what the edit side looks like, because a lot of people really don't understand it.
And if you do understand it, if you understood it 5 years ago, it's changing so quickly that it's hard to keep track.
That's exactly right.
I was at Condé Nast for 6 years, and I would say I think it changed more in those 6 years than in like the 150 before that.
but it's sad, and it's so true. I mean, it's just a completely different beast than it was, you know, when we graduated college. So let's walk through your career a little bit, because you've been at so many amazing places. You've been at Hearst, you've been at Condé, you're at DLN now, which is an amazing, amazing resource for designers. If you are a designer who's listening, I'm a member of DLN, and it's just a great organization that has really great professional resources and networking. But walk us through your career so far. Were you always interested in design and writing?
Yeah. Well, I think it's funny. I say that if I had known that, you know, writing about design was a career, I probably would have wanted to do that when I was, you know, 12 years old. But yeah, I didn't. And I think we get kind of pigeonholed. You know, I knew I loved writing, so it was like study English. And then ended up studying art history, which I could go on about for ages. I think a lot of people in this industry, interestingly, did. And I think it's so valuable, because I just fell in love with that, because it's, you know, a way of studying. You're learning about culture, you're learning about politics, you're learning about gender and art and design all through the lens of, you know, the historic, and it really teaches you to analyze visuals. So I think that's why so many people in the design industry have studied it. But, you know, then the idea was kind of, okay, you did art history, so go work in a museum. So I did internships with museums and auction houses, and I kind of thought I would do that. And then I realized, you know, if I was going to go work in a gallery in New York City, it'd be like a front desk receptionist for 7 years before I got to do anything creative.
Totally different track, and no writing.
Exactly. And I knew I loved to write. And again, the interior designer aspect of it is interesting, because my mother is a big antique person and decorated our house. So I think growing up, I was very aware of antiques and design. When I was about 9 years old, I insisted on painting my own desk and dresser and bookshelf set for my bedroom.
I love that.
Color polka dots, very chic.
Very chic.
Like, I was aware of that, but I don't think I understood that it was really a profession, let alone writing about it. And then I ended up getting a job as an assistant at Condé Nast. And that was before that, when I first moved to New York for about 6 months while I job hunted, I worked in retail at ABC Home, which honestly was...
I didn't know that. Love that.
I think I still have glitter in my hair from doing the Christmas season there. But and just being a great resource, because, you know, all day I was like working with a lot of designer people who came in. And
yeah, I feel like retail is such a great first entry point into the industry.
You know, I really learned about a lot of the brands that ironically then I ended up, when I got to AD, writing about, or they ended up being advertisers, their partners now. So that was great. And then I got a job as an assistant at Condé Nast. I was working for a man named Tom Wallace. He had been the editor-in-chief of Condé Nast Traveler for, I think, 20 years. And then was serving as the editorial director. So he was the person to whom all the editor-in-chiefs reported. So that was just like the best training for seeing how magazines work, how the, you know, media world works. He was very generous with his time and knowledge with me, you know, kind of let me sit in on every meeting. So I learned so, so much.
Like a crash course.
You know, through that, I got to know Margaret Russell, who was writing AD at the time. And then when Tom left the company, she kindly offered me a job, and I went to AD, and then I ended up being a market editor there for about 2.5 years. And then I moved to digital because it was 2016 or whatever, and I thought this is where the world's going. When Amy came on, she wanted to launch this kind of professional section of the site, which became AD Pro, and I did that.
And you were the founding editor of AD Pro.
Exactly. And then I met with Jo Salt soon after she'd taken over House Beautiful. I thought it was really interesting, her vision. We really connected. I went over there and, you know, it was interesting because I had been at AD for so long, kind of talking to the niche, like top of the top interior designers. And then I thought it was a really interesting challenge to kind of bring that design I love to a super wide audience. So we were doing that, especially during COVID, a massive audience, and kind of helping people, you know, be happy in their homes during that time, which was really gratifying. We did a lot of fun things.
Yeah.
When I, you know, kind of felt there are a lot of, I think we might get deeper into, you know, the kind of intricacies of media right now, but I felt like I wanted to get a little bit back to, you know, really storytelling, being close with designers.
More traditional editorial.
Yeah, and less of what digital has become now, which is a lot of kind of, you know, total massive traffic based, affiliate revenue based. I felt like I was looking a little more at spreadsheets and revenue than I wanted to as an editor. And frankly, that anyone should have let me do. But wow, here I am.
It really does astound me how in the past 6, 7, you know, maybe 8 years, it's gone so much from a storytelling, editorial, curated point of view to very spreadsheet numbers, SEO, you know, everything that's driving editorial now.
I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on this. And the funny thing is, I think a lot of magazine media has kind of lost sight of the original purpose. And there's a difference between evolving and losing sight of that, right? Like the reason all these magazines came about was 150 years ago, we had newspapers that went to everyone. They read the same things. And then people started thinking, why don't we develop a special publication for people who love golf or design or beauty? And those became magazines as we know it. And those were 50 to 100 years were really shaping, you know, Vogue was kind of shaping what people, they were setting trends, they were setting styles. And then the internet came and kind of shook all things up. And I think, you know, the biggest mistake was magazines were so late to the internet game. I mean, I started at Condé Nast in 2014, and some of their websites were only a year old. Like, it's insane. There were magazines who thought this is a passing fad and buried their head in the sand. So they were late to it. And then, you know, with the internet, anyone could put stuff out there. We're competing. Everything was free in the beginning. So we made a mistake. You know, you always say you can make something expensive and discount it, but you can't go the other way. So content out there for free for years and years. And now in the past few years, people have started, you know, trying to paywall and do subscription models. But that's really hard when people have been used to getting things for free.
100%.
Always make this point. It's interesting. You know, 10 years ago, if you're an editor at AD, your competition is El Decor or Lux or whatever. Now, as editors, you're competing against the designers themselves because they can look what you're doing, Ariel, with really, you're doing your own podcast. You can put your project directly on Instagram. So you have to be more creative than ever. But then ironically, at the same time, I think, you know, not to get into the boring details, but, you know, ad revenue isn't as much as it used to be. So they're looking for alternate revenue streams. So we're saying, okay, you know, affiliate revenue, we can do SEO, you know, shopping guides, and that's all well and good, but some of these things become opposing strategies, right? You can't be trying to get as many viewers as possible and get affiliate revenue, but also be trying to do this really high-end content you pay well. So I think there's been a bit of whiplash of not knowing what the vision is. And, you know, magazines have lower budgets than ever before. I think, you know, it's interesting hearing people talk about some of the brands that are doing interesting editorial now. Again, often it's not necessarily magazine brands.
Like Frederick.
I was joking to someone the other day. I think the only magazine that shoots and styles and produces 100% of its own content is Frederick, which is
Schumacher.
Right. It's like, that kind of makes sense. You know, it takes, you know, a revenue stream to do that. What I think is really interesting is now how many people are going to, you know, the Substack model or the, you know, private newsletter where the last few years, you know, every publication turned into a lifestyle publication. Like you open Twitter, Facebook, wherever you get news and you see Kylie Jenner wore these pants and you see the same story covered in, you know, Elle in, you know, Harper's Bazaar in Teen Vogue. They're all cannibalizing the same content. And the story isn't even part of an interview or anything exclusive. It's like something someone saw on Instagram. So rehashing the same content. And so people don't have that loyalty anymore. And then you saw, you know, popular writers spinning off their own. I love Elizabeth Holmes, who does so many thoughts on fashion of the family.
She's amazing.
She has her own Substack.
I feel like a Substack is like, you know, the modern day equivalent of an indie magazine.
Exactly. And that's what I felt when I came to the DLN. I was kind of like, look, the reality is I don't need to struggle to create content for 10 million people. And then when it's 10 million, have a goal of 11 million the next month. And this
like a hamster wheel.
I'd rather create content for, you know, 600 people who really care about design and love it and they're going to appreciate it and pay for it.
I feel like you need to write a book about the state of media right now, honestly.
I have to wait until, you know, some more people are dead. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, it wouldn't be your first book. You've already written a book. You know you can do it.
Yeah, and I love the book aspect. And we've got a lot in store in terms of books with the DLN, too, which is really exciting. But I think that's also interesting, Ariel, right? Everyone wants a book now in interior design. Everyone wants this beautiful coffee book. And again, it's like that pushback. You know, we had magazines, then we went all digital, everything, and everything felt so kind of throwaway and temporary. And now everybody wants to produce a book.
Yeah, because it is nice to have something physical that's a representation of, you know, fully you that, you know, you're putting together.
Absolutely. You know, we do still value that. And I think that's important.
You're just so eloquent about the way you speak about your experience in media. I feel like this isn't even on my list, but I just feel like people in the industry are often so confused about how to approach journalists, how to, you know, how do I get published? How do I, and I'm sure lots of people listening are kind of, you know, coming with that mindset. What do you think some of your best advice would be to someone who, you know, maybe never has been published, or maybe it was just like a small pickup somewhere? Like, what do you think are the crucial things for people to know in the design editorial world?
Well, number one, actually, I would say don't be afraid to reach out. I mean, I get people that are, you know, ask me all the time, can you look at this project and let me know, just even kind of as advice. I guess just this is just kind of advice in life. Like, the worst someone can say is no, or they can ignore you.
My mom has told me that forever.
Exactly. Don't be afraid to reach out, but also don't waste someone's time, right? So here are things that I want as an editor, as much as me. First of all, I want it to be clear that you know my magazine or site or whatever it is.
Do your homework.
Show that you're familiar, and then have a clear pitch. And I think when I speak to designers, this can manifest in different ways. Obviously, when you're talking to a publicist, it's a little different. It's like, you want to craft the story and make sure the pitch is clear. And what's the point? For designers, you're often pitching your projects, right?
Yeah.
Which is great. We want images. We want easily accessible images. And we want the images. Obviously, we want a synopsis, you know, where the home is, what it was. But also, again, when I get back to like, there's much more competition now. There needs to be a compelling story, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is something that, you know, was it a renovation that had an unexpected hurdle? Was it for a family that, you know, lives in some sort of unconventional way that you had to take into account? Just getting behind the details. I think sometimes, you know, designers do get caught up in like, it's so beautiful, the photos speak for themselves. And sure, they can, but that's not going to cut it anymore.
It's not enough anymore. Yep.
Yeah. And then I also think, like, kind of along those lines, I always say to people, you know, if you've got one great space, but it has a really good takeaway, or, you know, a before and after of a single space, great. We'd love to hear it. Again, as long as there's a good story there, anything that's kind of, you know, creative problem solving, those can be stories as well.
That's such a good takeaway. First of all, I agree with you. I think people are afraid to just cold email, which I think some of the best things that have ever happened to me in my career have come from a cold email.
You got
to
do it.
Is there a favorite element about the writing process for you? I feel like you've done so many different iterations of editorial.
I just love hearing about people's work and the creative things they do and their influences. And when you can kind of see a thread, you know, there are times when I say, oh, this reminds me of, you know, X historic building or architect. And then the designer says, oh, I was looking at this. You know, it's cool to kind of get in the heads of designers and see, you know, see how they work.
I also feel like you're so good about not being a gatekeeper in that way. Like, you've seen so much and learned so much about the industry and so many different facets of it. And you're so free with the information. And I feel like so many people get very close to the vest when, you know, they've been an editor for a long time. And I think it's a disservice to the industry to gatekeep things.
I definitely believe that. And I try that. And I think, you know, we've had a lot over the past few years of conversation about, you know, increasing diversity in the industry and opening doors. And how do we do that kind of operating in the same circles? So, I mean, frankly, that's why I love Instagram so much. I think, you know, it's an incredible tool if you're a young designer. I discover people and things, projects on Instagram all the time.
Me too. Vendors even.
Right. You can be creating this kind of like virtual storefront. And there are people who really kind of use that to kind of jumpstart their careers. And then, you know, on the flip side, I think even as it pertains to designers too, it's like, we all love this industry. I was just having this conversation in Mexico with one of our designers about, even with, you know, design professionals being hesitant to share sources or whatever. It's so many of these, especially crafts, handmade things, are in danger of dying out. It's like, let's share them so everyone's business does well.
Yes.
I think the takeaway is like, there's more than enough business to go around.
I'm always of that mentality. And what's meant for you will come to you.
And if you don't have a lot of business, that's not another designer's fault. You know, that's maybe you need to look at what you're doing, the economy, fine. But there's more than, I don't think we need to be competitive in this industry, and we should want all our partners and sources to succeed so that they're still there.
Especially like upholstery. I mean, upholstery alone. And like, skilled labor is just so hard to find. And I think I agree with you, just celebrating and lifting up these artisans in our community is definitely something that we all should be doing so that they can continue to do the amazing work that they do. Decorative painters, upholsterers, everything.
Absolutely.
You know, I love everything about your tastes. I feel like Hadley and I track very much on the same page of things that have a little bit of patina and comfort. What do you think your home says about you?
Oh my God, I think your home says everything about you. But the key is, your home says everything about you, whether you want it to, or whether you know that or not. So
yes.
That's funny because, you know, people who care about design put a lot into that. But if you don't care about design, your house is still telling a story about you. So watch out. I think that's something that we've really, people like us, designers or people who appreciate design, have always understood the transformative power of being in a space and what that can do to your mental health, your mood, you know, your workflow. But I think really the few years of being stuck inside during COVID made so many more people realize that and kind of think, oh, yeah, I want to be surrounded by things that make me happy or by colors I like, not by a blank wall. Like, you know what, maybe I will clean up this clutter because it's stressing me out. And I think that's so important. I recently joined the board of this amazing nonprofit in DC, which is where I live, called the Oasis Alliance. And they provide pro bono design services to survivors of trauma. So people,
which is amazing,
domestic violence, or who are, you know, making their way out of incarceration or homelessness. And, you know, the kind of key element to that really is you to be set up for success. Your home, your space around you is such a key part of that, of just feeling kind of peace and tranquility, and then feeling like you can be set up for, you know, finding a job, creating a stable home. We actually just did a story in our first DLN quarterly about Kelly Finley, a designer out of Oakland and now Atlanta, does a similar thing. She has a nonprofit arm of her business called the Joy Street Initiative, and they do kind of the same thing. And that's that whole idea that, you know, we understand deeply as designers, like how you can't, you know, set your kid up for success and send them to school well-rested and feeling great if like they're sleeping on a sleeping bag on the floor, you know, you need, and then just for your own serenity to be kind of surrounded by things that make you feel at rest and centered and safe. So I think that obviously that is kind of an extension on that question, but that's what your home says about you, but also kind of what your, how your home impacts you.
I love that. And I love that you're doing that. I reached out to MSK recently about volunteering our design time there because BCRF is very close to my heart and MSK. And I think when you're going through trauma, whether it's medical trauma or something is going on in your life, to have, like you said, an oasis at home, and it doesn't have to be fancy, you know, it's just something that's...
Absolutely. And I think that's the key too. And that's really why, you know, when I thought I'd work in art and I moved, obviously I said it was because of the writing and creativity, which it definitely was. But also there's a part of me, I think the way that the art world manifests in New York City especially is a little bit, you know, small world, niche, elitist in a way. And I think one of the great line, you know, you can look at these incredible magazines at the ADs and El Decors and Lux and galleries of the world. And obviously those are, you know, aspirational. That's top tier. There's a lot of wealth there. But there are so many lessons that you can take, you know, whether you've got that or you're in a dorm room or you're in a one bedroom apartment.
Absolutely.
Everybody has, you know, everybody can kind of manifest something in their home that, you know, that reflects them. And that's why it's so important to have that space, obviously.
Totally. Where do you think you find the most inspiration? I mean, there are so many different outlets now, whether it's a digital, a print, a Substack, Instagram. And you also have such an appreciation for the history of design too. So there's so many different avenues.
On a day-to-day basis, look, I can't, yeah, Instagram. I'm on Instagram all the time. It's bad. You shouldn't even see my, you know, time spent. I love it. I follow so many designers. It's always, you know, it's creative. I go down rabbit holes and that's amazing. And I think almost as a part of that, I know this is a cliche answer to give simply, but I'll expand upon it. I mean, travel is so huge for me. Like we just got back from Mexico City and then went to Oaxaca. Just the use of color, the kind of saturation, the light there in that city. We were there during the Day of the Dead festivities too. So there's all that, really an orange fan, but there are these beautiful marigolds decorating everything. And so I kind of have a newfound appreciation for that. And everyone on our trip was saying the same. I think you might start to see, you know, like a few DLN members doing some orange interiors coming up.
Marigold velvet. It's the new trend. You heard it here.
I joke, you know, my partner and I, luckily he's the same way, loves historic houses as well. And we've gone for the past few years to Charleston for New Year's. And it's funny because people will say, oh, well, what do you do? What do you like to do there? And we're like, you know, we eat and we drink and we walk around and look at old houses.
That's what Ben and I do when we go away. I mean, it's what's better than that?
Exactly. And that's my, wherever I go in the world, I always like to, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an old house, but to go wherever and look at architecture, look at, I mean, I love house museums. I love seeing how people lived in those spaces, but just like getting a sense of neighborhoods, seeing different architecture in different cities on different continents. I'm very lucky to be able to do that, to do a lot of it for work and then to travel for pleasure as well. And I just, that's huge for me. I think, again, to your point of, you know, getting actually in a space and experiencing it, you learn so much about kind of scale and just experience than you can always get, you know, through Instagram or Pinterest.
Absolutely. I think that's also been a really key thread through this season as we've been recording. So many people have emphasized, and they vary the gamut from designers to editors to stylists, but they've all emphasized the importance of travel. And it's so key and important to developing your eye and to developing your understanding of you know, decorative arts and architecture and history and culture and how people live in different places. And it also helps you just zoom out a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And give the context. And then context on a broad scale too. I mean, we had this really interesting conversation with when we were in, I know I keep referring to Mexico, but you know, we just got back and we're in Oaxaca. We went to the ruins of this, you know, ancient Zapotec era temple in Mitla.
That is so cool.
And I was talking to Eric Groft from Own Van Sweden, who's a well-known landscape designer. And you're walking around this and you're thinking, oh my God, you know, we in the design world so often are attributing everything to, you know, everything that's kind of classically proportioned to Greeks and Romans. And you're looking at this, and you see a lot of those same proportions that were happening, you know, down in Mexico in the pre-Hispanic times before any Europeans had settled there. So it's really interesting to just have that kind of context and think about, okay, you know, we have certain paradigms that we, you know, maybe grew up with educationally or from where we're from, but to get out of that and see, you know, what was happening in different populations in different areas over time, I think is just so good for, and gives you a new perspective of looking at things. I mean, there was pattern and thing there that was going on there that I'm kind of like, I've never seen any of that. And we're all talking about, I want to turn that into a textile or something. Just the more exposure you can get to things like that, the better.
Absolutely. What do you think have been the three biggest influences on your aesthetic in your life?
Oh my God, that's hard. Okay, well, first, I think definitely going back to childhood, I grew up in a 300-year-old home surrounded by antiques. My mother, as I said, is an antique collector. So I definitely think that was huge. Then the second, I think, has to be just, I mean, my time interviewing, you know, countless designers and architects, and I've learned so many lessons from them. Third, and maybe most recently, which is really interesting, and we talk about this a lot, I have maybe an idea that someday we'll write a book about this, but I'm a lifelong New Yorker and I moved in last year down to Washington. I now live with my partner who also has his own kind of very specific aesthetic and a lot of things from his family. So kind of learning to blend those. It's been an interesting exercise in each of us having to, I think, kind of define our style a little bit and figure out, you know, how it works together.
I think it helps you to evolve your own style when you are forced to combine collections with someone.
Exactly. It totally does. We have, you know, we see eye to eye on a lot of things. We have a lot of overlap, but then there are things that are, you know, kind of on the opposite sides of our Venn diagram that I think both of us have kind of pushed each other out of our comfort zones with that. So that's been really interesting and fun.
I love that. I remember when Ben and I first moved in together, he had this Charles Woodson framed jersey because he's like a crazy Michigan fan. And I was like, yeah, that's going in the bathroom where no one's going to see it.
Is it still in the house?
It's in the basement. It actually works with, we set up like a little, like our Peloton and whatever, and it works down there. It makes sense there.
It makes sense down there. No, I get it. It's not like going over the dining room table.
No, it's definitely not a hero piece by any means, but it's still here. I didn't cut it. I didn't get rid of it.
But it's okay. You can figure out how to work with it.
Exactly. We figure out the blend. Speaking of merging collections, I know you are a collector. What is your favorite thing to collect and what do you collect?
Well, anyone who's been in my house can tell you I collect anything tabletop.
You have a great china collection.
Thank you. It's always growing. And now I've been like seriously enabled since I moved out of my one bedroom apartment. So I bought a ton of plates in Mexico with these cool stoneware ceramic plates. I'm insane to travel with. I once carried a bird cage home as my carrier from Italy.
It's so funny. Well, let's walk into our little, at the end of each podcast, we have a little rapid fire question thing, which I love because the questions aren't really, they're like tangential to interior design, but they're not really about it. It's more just about personality. So what is your favorite food?
Okay. I mean, bread, like good bread and butter.
Oh, I love that answer. I mean, I could just eat bread and butter for the rest of my life and be really happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Favorite drink?
I mean, my go-to cocktail is usually like a tequila with lime juice and soda.
Tequila is my spirit of choice.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Favorite film?
Well, I have to say for interiors reasons, although now it's kind of like controversial, I just adore Call Me By Your Name just for like the scene setting. Everything visual about that. I know we have like got some problems now, but I'll stick to that.
I think that's allowed. It's a beautiful, the sets are beautiful.
I know.
Favorite hotel?
I just stayed at the Time Hotel in England this summer, and it was just such a magical, beautiful hotel.
I keep hearing about that.
Yes. built into the English countryside in the Cotswolds, lavender fields everywhere. They have incredible kind of farm to table restaurants.
And it's thyme as in, not as in time, but time as in like.
T-H-Y-M-E. And I'm going to give one more because also when I was in England, we stayed at a place called Le Manoir au Quatre Saisons. And it's by a French chef who settled in England, in Oxfordshire, and opened also beautiful gardens, farm to table, incredible restaurant, and just the most adorable interior. So those are two recent favorites.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Favorite city?
My favorite city is Paris. It's close between Paris and New York, but, you know, I'm sorry to New York. I'm a lifelong New Yorker, but I'm going to go with Paris.
I'm with you. Also the shopping and the antiquing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the bread and butter area.
The bread and butter. Exactly. This is where we're going to just make a list of cities ranked on the quality of their bread and butter.
Yeah.
Favorite bedding? People, I feel like people are so particular about their bedding in our industry. I always like to ask.
Yeah, I love anything patterned. I mean, favorite, if I could have it all day, every day, would be Porto.
Yeah, me too.
Unfortunately, I don't have like the, you know, linen closet full of Porto that like is on display at Oak Spring, but I would love that. That would be my dream. Yeah.
I know. Something I love that I think Rita Koenig said once was invest in bedding piece by piece. So over time, over the course of years, you kind of put together this little like trousseau of bedding. And then it's something she was saying that like one day her daughter will have and that she can pass down like the Porto and XYZ. And you just do it piece by piece. I mean, I only have little boudoir pillows, so it'll take me 700 years to get my trousseau. But
Oak Spring did like a cool little exhibit of Bunny Mellon's linens last year.
That's amazing.
She had a ton of Porto and, you know, table linens that she designed with Givenchy. Amazing, amazing stuff. But one of my favorite things, and there was this note, she had Bobby Kennedy come stay with her shortly after JFK's assassination in Antigua, I believe. And there's a note from him to her. And he says, "Dear Bunny, you've completely changed my life. I had no idea that anything other than white sheets existed. And now I've just like blown half of my salary ordering, you know, beautiful, colorful pattern sheets."
Stop.
And happier. I think that's really funny.
That's an incredible story.
That's how sheets can change your life.
They can. They absolutely can. Oh my God, that's incredible. Tea or coffee, and how do you take it?
I'm drinking my coffee right now. I have it iced with oat milk.
And you're an Arnold Palmer girl like me.
Oh, I do love an Arnold Palmer. Yeah, yeah. I do actually love iced tea too. I drink iced tea probably once a day as well.
We're all over caffeinated.
Yeah.
Favorite playlist?
I would say anything based around Fleetwood Mac.
Love that.
Ian McGraw, I'm a Stevie Nicks fan.
Uh-huh. Favorite weekend activity?
Obviously, do you even need to ask? Obviously, it's antiquing, walking around any junk shop or flea market or estate sale I can find.
And lastly, which is, I think, the hardest question, favorite design book?
Oh my God, Ariel, that's insane.
I know. You can't even. We also should plug, Hadley wrote an incredible book about Windsor down in Florida that everybody should check out. Speaking of books and the history of design and architecture, it's a wonderful book.
Thank you. Thank you. My favorite design book, again, this feels like I'm having to make a really difficult choice. And also, you would laugh if you saw my house because it has about 500 books.
I know. Me too. It's so bad.
And I really love all of them.
Thomas's book is amazing.
Thomas's book. Yeah. Thomas is my partner and he has a recent book out for listeners. Yeah. I guess I'll plug his book.
Yeah.
That one, because it won't seem like I'm playing favorites.
Such a good girlfriend.
He wrote a book with two co-authors, Brian Huffman and Linda Jane Holden, about Bunny Mellon, who's his grandmother, called Bunny Mellon Style.
Which is a fantastic book.
References to Oak Spring. But I do think I love that combination of kind of personal mementos and artifacts and anecdotes with style. And that's an interesting book because, you know, this was not someone who was a professional designer by any means, but created such a distinct style that has influenced many people, myself very much included. Since, you know, even before we knew each other. So
for people who don't know about Bunny and the influence she's had on interior design, the biography that Meryl Gordon wrote also is really good too. Well, I feel like we packed so much into this. I could keep talking to you for 4 hours because I just love you so much. What are you working on right now? Are there any new projects you can tell me about?
Yeah. So I am working, we're working on it. We just came out with our first issue. You know, when I came out to the DLN, we revamped, there had been a somewhat quarterly magazine, and I kind of revamped that. You know, I felt like what we really needed, and, you know, this was something that Michael and Peter Salig, our founder, and our board had been discussing for a while too. We wanted something that felt like, you know, didn't compete with our design magazines that we love, many of which are media partners of ours, but something that really felt like it was peer to peer and kind of a little bit more into the nitty gritty of design and a little more personal. So we joke, it's like church newsletter meets design publication. It's just called the DLN Quarterly. We just filed our first issue last month.
It's wonderful. I was so excited when I got it because you can tell, and this is a compliment to you and your stewardship of editorial, you can tell that you were behind it, and it also let the members shine and felt very DLN, which I think is a hard fine line to balance.
Well, thank you. So now that we're working on the second issue, and along with that, we're launching something called the Partner Sourcebook, which we had done a kind of catalog exhibition of our partner brands before, but we're going to editorialize a little bit more so it will feel like a really kind of useful source for our designer members on new launches and services and news from our partner brands, which range from, you know, like Maison et Objet, the fair, to Laura Piana Interiors, to Benjamin Moore. So we've got like paint, furnishings, you know, services. So I'm excited to work on that. And then hopefully you'll be hearing more from us on this soon. But I think I mentioned to you that we're in the works of figuring out a book program. And our goal is to do a book.
That's amazing.
Yeah, a book every year. That's a compilation focused on a room of the house showing, you know, work on projects from our members and our partners. So we're really excited.
Wow.
I think that will take the place of, you know, again, like we were saying, people want books because they want, you know, we get our news regularly from, you know, social media and in our, you know, email, whatever. And in our minds, we kind of feel, okay, the quarterly can be this more casual peer-to-peer thing. And then we'll save the big, beautiful, amazing photography for a book. And then that way too, we're not, you know, competing with any of the magazines. We can, you know, show spaces that have been published elsewhere and really kind of have our pick of the best rooms from our members. So I'm super excited about that. We'll have an official kind of announcement for that in the next couple of weeks.
I love that. That'll be amazing. Where can listeners find more about you?
You can find more about me on Instagram. It's Hadley Keller, hadleykeller.com. I think you can, is a website you can see work I've done and find contact information for me. I joke that I'm very easily findable. I'm not trying to be hard to reach. So if you Google me, you'll probably find my personal email address and my work email address. So I'm easy to track down. Please do.
Fabulous. I highly encourage any listener in the industry to have a coffee with Hadley because it is some of the best industry conversation you can have. And also she's just absolutely lovely.
So are you, Ariel. I'm so honored to be on this with you. I'm so excited. And I'm excited to listen to all the other great interviews you'll have too.
Thank you. I am so grateful to you for coming on, and I'm so glad we got to do this. You are such a delight, and I'm really excited to see you the next time you're in the city.
Yes. Oh, we'll see each other soon, for sure.
That's a wrap for this week's episode of Talk Shop. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more thoughtful discussions and amazing guests. Make sure you follow on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify so you never miss an episode. And of course, follow me at Ariel Oaken. See you next week.